Talking back in take two. Okay. Is that better? Okay. Yeah, what I want us to do this morning is to imagine that all of that stuff that I talked about last night, you know, we talked about the issue of campus speech codes and the university interfering with freedom of association and all of the things that they try to do to dominate the marketplace of ideas, or I should say, in effect, shut it down for students. I want us to imagine that we've brought in the legislature and done all the things that needed to be done and that we've, you know, won some important cases with the ADF and the ACLJ, and we've gotten to a point where we now have a free and open marketplace of ideas on a college campus. Well, we're not all the way home yet, are we? Once we win the right to speak freely and open up the marketplace of ideas, we have to figure out what exactly are we going to say in a hostile environment? How are we going to go about navigating the debate? It's one thing to win the right to exercise your speech. It's another thing to offer good speech and good arguments. And so what I want to do this morning is to kind of focus on a couple of things. We're going to move on to the abortion issue later and kind of talk about how do we go through, maybe in a hostile environment on a secular campus, when you're just getting bombarded with all of these arguments, how do you respond in a way that allows you to remain in the driver's seat in the argument? But before we get to that, I want to talk about, we got some former students here from Summit who have heard the lecture on how to take Sociology 101. What I'm going to do is to share that lecture, that basic lecture, with everyone here, because this is something that I usually do at Summit Ministries, where I'm talking to the kids, and so many of the kids are getting ready to go off into that hostile environment. We talk about how hostile an environment the secular university is, but boy, just ratchet it up a couple of notches when you walk into Sociology 101, because that's generally the worst experience that they'll have, because that's just a full frontal assault on their Christian worldview. I'll explain why that is not an overstatement at all. But I want to share that with you guys today because, you know, just as the talk is helpful for people who go into that environment, young people who go into that environment, it's also helpful for parents and grandparents when they've had a kid who's gone off, and you know, they just figured that they prepared the child to go off to college and to have their faith endure that assault. You know, they read the Bible with them, and they took them to church, and maybe took them to some Bible camps and things of that nature. And then they go off to the university, and this kid comes back 4 months later and is completely different. Well, how do you have the conversation with that person? Well, this lecture tells you exactly how to navigate that. And so I developed this. I want to explain to you guys why I developed this. Back in 2011, at the end of doing 7 sessions at Summit, I told the students, if you guys are under assault in the classroom, I want you to send me an email and just kind of describe to me what you're going through. And it was interesting because I got different emails describing different problems, but they were dominated by, my sociology professor said this. I mean, it's like the majority of the emails that I got were all from the same class. Well, why? It's because at most secular universities, you have to take that as a part of the general studies, and they do it their freshman year, and it's by far the worst experience that they have. And so I thought about it. I said, it would kind of be cool to come back the next year. I threw this idea past John Stone Street. I said, hey, John, I've been doing these lectures, and I'm thinking about doing a new one that just talks about how to take Sociology 101. And he called Jeff Myers, and Jeff just loved the idea and said, oh, we need to do more of this, okay? So I put this thing together, and I think you guys have the handout, don't you, basically, that lays things out. And you'll notice what it is. It's basically a bunch of questions here because I've always talked to students about the importance of going into a hostile environment and not simply walking in there and making assertions. If you walk in as a young Christian into a sociology class and you just start saying things, you're never going to say something that the college professor hasn't already heard. And they have these canned, prepared answers that are intended to make you look really stupid in front of your peers. But the thing that they're not ready for is pointed questions. If you make a commitment not to make statements, but instead ask questions that poke holes in their worldview, you're going to turn the tables on them completely. And I want to turn to the questions right now. And I want to really explain to you guys what the purpose of the questions is. You notice here that they're kind of bundled into different categories here. The first category says questions intended to challenge the notion that socialism is good. One of the things that you're absolutely guaranteed to experience in a sociology class, and this is something you'll notice when your kids come home from college, is that they have been inundated with socialism, basically. Because if you look at sociology, if you know, many of you are asking, well, what is sociology? Well, sociology is supposed to be a social science, and it is supposed to be the science of how, the scientific study of how social processes and institutions affect human behavior. Because, you know, we all kind of are raised to think that you're just a function of the choices that you make, basically. You make choices, and your choices have consequences. In the sociology class, what they're really trying to do is to turn that around and talk about how your choices in life are limited by larger social processes out there. And that's why they'll talk about institutional racism and discrimination and classism. They're trying to talk about various forms of social determinism. And so naturally, if they're going to be talking about social institutions, well, they're going to be talking about the economy and economics. That's just going to be a huge thing that they're going to go over. And what you're going to find is that the overwhelming majority of the teachers, whether it's your graduate student or whether it's the feminist assistant professor or full professor, they are Marxist in their worldview. And they are trying to teach socialism, and they're trying to undermine capitalism. And so what I want you guys to do is to be prepared on the very first day of class when you walk in for those arguments. So what's the first thing that you ask? You ask, when you get the syllabus on the very first day of class, you ask, would GPA redistribution lower academic standards? Let me explain that. That sounds like a weird question to ask on the first day of class, but it's not weird at all. Because the first thing they're going to do with you is hand out a course syllabus. And the course syllabus is going to have all the class rules, and it's going to tell all of the things that you need to succeed in the class. And what it'll do is say, we have A's, B's, C's, D's, and F's. And generally speaking, it'll explain that you got to take 3 exams and they'll all be averaged together and we have a 10-point curve. And you guys know the drill, basically. It's going to talk about what you need to do to succeed in the class, and you're going to have grading policies there. Well, this is where I actually came up with a very creative satire that I wrote a few years ago. I write a lot of different satires, and I think that some of them just kind of fall flat, but others are just a little bit better. And one that I wrote back in January of 2009, I think is probably, columnists have favorite columns that they've written. And this was my favorite, I think. It was called My New Spread the Wealth Grading Policy. And I wrote this thing in 2009, and it was after Barack Obama had been sworn in as president, and all of my students were just adoring him, and we had had all of this, you know, this big controversy had happened during the election with Joe the Plumber, and the whole idea of the spread the wealth economic policy. Well, in January, I went and gave my first exam to my students, and then I sent out this email to all of them, which was actually a satire that I turned into a column that I wrote for townhall.com called My New Spread the Wealth Grading Policy. And I wrote to them, and I said, well, you know, guys, we talked at the beginning of the semester about how we have A, B, C, D, and F. But, you know, I just gave that first examination, and the results of it were really not quite what I expected. I'm really upset that a number of you failed the examination. But I also noticed that a lot of people got A's on the examination. And, you know, why should that be? I mean, we have a policy at the university that says you only need a 2.0 grade point average to graduate. And so all of those people who got 4 grade points, who are all the way up at A, well, that's just like surplus intellectual wealth. I mean, in a sense, they don't really need all of those points to graduate. So I know that I gave you a policy the first day of class, but I'm the dictator in this class, and I tell you exactly what the rules are, and I've decided to change my mind. I'm going to take 10 points off of all the people who made A's in the class, and I'm going to give those points to people who made F's. so that we can have greater equality in the grade distribution. So now we're only going to have B's, C's, and D's. And by the way, I know that many of you are upset that I've changed the rules, but again, I dictate things because I'm the dictator. And I want you guys to know that if we still have this persistent pattern of inequality here in our little society, then I reserve the right after the second examination, if we've still got those B's, C's, and D's, well, I reserve the right to take 10 points off of the average of people who have B's in the class and give it to the people who have D's, and that means everyone has a C. Remember, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, you need to have a C average to get out of the university, and the C could stand for communism, but I prefer just to say that it represents collectivism. And I sent this to the students, and then I published it on townhall.com. And it was kind of cool because Neil Bortz, the libertarian, picked it up and he read it on the air twice and he thought it was just hysterical, but actually hysterical is sexist, we'll say hysterical. So at any rate, you know, it's floating around on the internet for a long time, and for some reason, 2.5 years after that, I get a call from Glenn Beck when all this crazy stuff is going on in, what was that, around probably around October of 2011 with all the Occupy Wall Street stuff. And he wants to fly me up to Manhattan to go and do this big in-studio interview and talk about, you know, communism and how students learn that in college and how they can unlearn it. And he wants me to talk about this column. And it was so awesome. He gave me 8 minutes to stand up and do a whole monologue on this on Glenn Beck TV. And it was really a cool thing because he had a college student audience out there. And I was able to sit there and talk to them and say, you know, this is actually really an important exercise because everyone understands that a spread the wealth grading policy won't work because it will destroy the academic work product. I already have to suffer as a professor who teaches 3 miles from the Atlantic Ocean. I teach near Wrightsville Beach. What do you think it's going to be like for me next month in the month of April when the sun is out and everyone wants to go to the beach? The already subpar academic performance of my students is going to go down. I spend most of my time threatening them to try and get them, you know, shaking my finger at them to try and get them to perform well. Imagine if we actually had a system in place that said that everyone's outcome is determined beforehand and nothing that they can do affects their outcome. What would be the result? What would be the effect on the academic work product? It's already bad. It's subpar. It would plummet substantially. And so as I explained to those students, if a spread the wealth grading policy would destroy the academic work product, the academic standard, then basically a spread the wealth economic policy, because of human nature, would destroy the standard of living in America. Because people would not be willing to work for someone else's good if their outcome is already determined in advance. Because people are self-interested, we will see society go down the tubes, and the standard of living for everyone is simply going to be destroyed. And so I got up and I explained that to the students, and that's, you know, I had 8 minutes to do the monologue. But basically, if you're taking Sociology 101, you don't have 8 minutes throughout the course of the entire semester to talk to your professor and try and influence the students. So what do you need to do? Well, you need to just ask that question the first day, because they won't see it coming. You just ask the question, well, I noticed that you have this hierarchy of grades. Why do you do that? Why don't you just give everyone the same grade? Catch them off guard. And the honest answer is, I can't do that, of course. There has to be an incentive for you to perform. You won't perform if there's no incentive. And just get them to say that on the very first day of class, because you will not make it 1 month in Sociology 101 before they get up there and begin to talk about socialism and why capitalism is evil and socialism is good. And so then you're prepared. Look at question number 2. Would wealth redistribution lower the overall standard of living? The answer is going to be no from your professor. Do you understand when you confront them with that, They will say no. And it's just like you've caught a person at a trial contradicting their deposition under oath. You then say, hold on just a second. Previously, you said that if GPA distribution were to be implemented in the class, it would lower academic standards. How come that doesn't apply to economic redistribution? And you have just caught this person in a massive contradiction. And I want to explain why you're doing this. It's not your hope that your Marxist feminist professor in sociology is suddenly going to convert to capitalism and start to espouse the wonders of capitalism. You're not trying to influence that individual. You are trying to influence your peers because you have just destroyed your professor's credibility, and now they can take everything that they say throughout the course of the semester with a grain of salt. Everyone see how that works? Okay, now, I had a student a number of years ago, and I won't use any names, but Kevin Whitley approached me. He is an awesome kid, and he's a graduate of the university, and he was an honors student, and now he's a law enforcement officer, and he was incredibly frustrated by the experience of taking a sociology class under a professor, and again, I don't use names, but taking a course under Dr. Donna King. Whoops, it slipped out. Boy, this professor is just a flaming Marxist, basically. And he was so frustrated. And he says, I feel like I can't speak my mind in the class. And I said, well, you're right. You know, you really can't just speak your mind without consequences, but you can ask questions. And, you know, he said, what do I do when she goes off on this tangent about Marxism? And I said, well, there's this one question that you need to ask. And it's extremely important that we have one student ask this one question in every single class, and that concerns the Berlin Wall. Because what we have to understand about Karl Marx is that professors will get up and they will teach this stuff, but Karl Marx, very few people know how Karl Marx went about things in his academic career. He's obviously known for being the co-author of the Communist Manifesto, but what a lot of people don't bother to do is to read Das Kapital, which is his most lengthy discussion of capitalism and why it fails, and why it should fail, historically speaking. And what you have to understand about Karl Marx is that he never conducted a scientific experiment in his academic career. He never did that. And he never conducted a survey. He relied solely upon historical analysis. And we have to understand that Marxists focus on historical analysis. And that's why they are so focused on historical revisionism. And it's extremely important that we turn that around, because kids these days, college kids, were born in what decade? They were born in the 90s, and we are having the first generation of college students who were born after the Berlin Wall fell down. And that's one thing that we forget. When was the Berlin Wall built? It was built in the year 1962, and it fell down 27 years later. And a very important question that we have to ask is, why did they build the Berlin Wall? Why did they build the Berlin Wall? You keep talking about how this is an ideal economic system, but why did you have to build the Berlin Wall? And of course, the answer is that it was so, the theory was so terrible in practice that people were dying literally to get away from it. And so they had to build a wall to keep people in. And if you simply ask that question, what's going to happen? These young students who don't know much about the Berlin Wall because they're not being taught history in the schools anymore are now going to go off and do research on the Berlin Wall. And you've also laid the foundation for something else that I'm going to get to. By the way, these questions all have an immediate purpose and a long-term purpose. And they are laid down just as a lawyer sits down and lays out a cross-examination and has each and every single question in order because he's attempting to lay a trap. I am doing exactly the same thing here. Okay? Now, here's a question. Without a doubt, you're going to get into a massive discussion of cultural relativism if you take the course in sociology. And before you get into that, at some point after you ask the question about the Berlin Wall, you just have to directly ask the question, are you really saying that all nations and all cultures are equal to one another? And if you ask that question, they have to say, well, yes, that's what I'm saying. Okay? Because there's this interesting concept that you're going to be experiencing, young people, that you're going to be hearing about if you take this course. And that's the idea of ethnocentrism. Now, ethnocentrism, you'll hear it over and over and over from the sociologist. And what exactly does it mean? Well, ethnocentrism simply is the idea or the practice of judging other cultures by the standards of your own culture. And I have no problem with using the term ethnocentrism. Okay, fine. We do that. We have a tendency to judge other cultures by the standards of our own. Okay, that's a concept. That's a thing we do. It's a legitimate concept. But here's where it becomes illegitimate, where they begin to try and teach you the value of anti-ethnocentrism. See, what they're going to do is they're going to say, you know, that's just something we do, but we should not do that. We should not judge other cultures by the standards of our own culture. And you think about it for just a second, it's a logical contradiction, isn't it? Because the idea of anti-ethnocentrism is something that's only promoted by sociologists. And they're their own subculture, aren't they? And they're essentially saying, you shouldn't do that, okay? They're judging us by the standards of their own culture. You shouldn't do that. My way of doing things, you're ethnocentric, I'm anti-ethnocentric, I'm better than you are because I don't do that. I mean, you think about it for a second, there is this huge logical contradiction. But we don't need to really get hung up on that because there is a far bigger problem. And this is where I love this part of the lecture, is where I get to tell just a little piece of my conversion story. I was one of these individuals who used to talk about the value or the importance of anti-ethnocentrism. Because after I got a master's degree in psychology, I went off and got a PhD in criminology, and it was embedded within a sociology program. And so I was just swimming in all of this thinking. And so I used to sit here and talk about cultural relativism and how we shouldn't judge other cultures, and I would sort of selectively apply moral relativism as well. And I was just one of those individuals. I was a dishonest atheist. I know honest atheists, by the way, out there. They're wrong, but they're honest. For example, a lot of the Randians, the Ayn Rand followers of objectivism, they will sit there and say, oh yeah, there's definitely such a thing as absolute right and wrong, but I just don't know where it comes from. You know, there's the standard. I just have no idea where it comes from. You know what? It's wrong, but I can respect that. Okay, you're saying there's an absolute truth and you don't know what the source is. Okay, fine, you're wrong, but I respect you. But these individuals who sit there and pretend to believe in moral and cultural relativism, they're dishonest. And I was one of those people. And of course, you know the reason why. I was a professional musician, living a crazy style of life and running around with groupies and popping pills and doing all of this. And man, I couldn't deal with the hammer of objective morality at all. I could not deal with that reality in my life. And so not for intellectual reasons, but for reasons of lifestyle and emotional reasons, I'd adopted this. But then I had a very life-changing experience. In the year 1994, yet met a woman by the name of Marisol Mora, and we became, our relationship just really took off, and I did not know when we started dating that her dad was the head of the Socialist Party of Ecuador. I found out when it was time to go home and meet the parents in Quito. That was a very interesting experience. How come there are all these armed guards in front of your palace? It's like, this is weird. How come we can't go anywhere without a dude holding the machine gun? Well, the political leaders assassinate one another. Tell me more about that now that I'm here. Oh, now he's not, his name, by the way, is Medardo Mora, and he is actually now the head of the New Radical Leftist Party in Ecuador, and actually he was actually the head of the Constitutional Committee in 2007 when Ecuador wrote into their constitution a constitutional right to abortion. They were Catholic in name only, but leftist. And so I'm in this relationship, and I go down there in 1995, and we're sitting in a cafe, outside cafe in Guayaquil, and it's Marisol and I, and her good friend and the lawyer boyfriend was sitting with us. This couple is sitting with us, and of course the dude with the machine gun watching us. It's bizarre, but we begin to have this conversation in which the male lawyer begins to tell me in fluent English about the prison conditions down in South America. And the stories that he shared with me, I just didn't believe him. You ever hear that? People are telling stories about things going on in third world countries. You just don't believe them. Oh, really? There's nine people murdered in this prison in Guayaquil every day on average, and they do what to them, and so on and so forth. And you hear all these crazy stories. And I was so shocked by what I heard that I actually arranged a teaching exchange where I would come back in March of 1996 and teach at the San Francisco University just outside of Quito, beautiful university there in the Andes Mountains. And I would return because I had a connection that was going to allow me to actually go in with protection with a couple of English-speaking guards and actually walk through one of the prisons and actually go into the gates of hell and just see what happened. And I arranged this. On March 7th of 1996, I go walking into this damp dungeon up there in the mountains, in the Andes Mountains. Actually, it was in Quito, Ecuador. It wasn't outside. It was actually within the city limits. And I went in there for 3 hours. And, you know, I wish I could tell you everything that I experienced. But, you know, I sat in a prison cell, 36 square meters, with 45 men. And they're all just cramped in there, and there are only 16 beds in there, and there are 45 of them. And they're fighting over beds, and they'd sleep for a while. Someone just throws someone out. And there were actual weapons floating around, and there are people walking around. They've got cuts from knife fights. The problem is they're walking through puddles of urine and fecal matter mixed together because the pipes would break and there's no budget to fix them. They'd rely on private donations to fix them. And I actually walked through the place where they prepared the food. There are these big vats. And, I mean, this place makes McDonald's look so good to me. I mean, they would take the old vegetables from Old Town, from the old market in Old Town Quito. When they were too old to sell them, they'd cut them up. And you know those pigs that they hang up by the side of the road in South America? How many have been to seen the pig shacks? They'll hang them up, and they'll have a little stove on the front porch, and they'll just cut out some pig, and they'll serve it up. Never, ever, ever stopped at one of those places because the pig sits there overnight, and they just sit out. And when it starts to rot, what do? They give it to the prison. And so they make this version of low country gumbo that they have in South Carolina, but it's different. It's the rotten stuff. They cut it all up and they mix it together and they boil it in vats to kill whatever disease that there is and worms and things of that nature. That's what they do. And that's what they eat. And it's incredible because you've got to pay rent to eat. In order to live downstairs in the worst part of the prison, they had to pay 67 cents per week. That was 2,000 sucres at the time. And so outside in the streets, there are people, family members walking around with buckets, and it's got the prisoner's number. They've all got a number, and they're banging on them, saying, my kid has to eat, basically, because they know if the kid tries to eat without paying rent, they beat them. And I actually witnessed a beating where they took a small baseball bat, and they have to lean up against a wall, and they just beat them and beat them. I walked through, and all of a sudden, this one guard shouted, the two guards that were with me that spoke English, one of them shouted, tenemos visitas, which means you're violating his constitutional rights. I'm kidding. It means we have visitors. Stop. We don't want them to know that we do this. And so I go walking through, and I have the opportunity to go upstairs to the life of luxury that you get to experience if you're able to afford 5,000 sucres per week, which is $1.67. Okay, so you stay upstairs. What are the advantages? They actually can. There's a door. There's a hallway and a door. It's one of those half doors things where you actually walk. They open up the gate, and there's this little foyer, and people knock on it, and they actually will drop off clothes. People can bring you clothes from the outside. If not, you just sit there and wear your... They're covered with mildew. There are people who've been arrested in 2 years before, and they're wearing the same thing. It's unbelievable until the clothes fall off their back, and then it's somehow, you know, someone will donate something. It's insane. There's no budget for that. I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. It's insane. But you go upstairs, it's a little better because you also get to have personal effects. In a 36-square-meter cell, they're all the same size. There's only 20 people. and you get to have a Bible if you want that, if you want a picture of Jesus. You're allowed to have personal effects for the extra fee. And so I get this opportunity to talk to the guards, and I said, you know, I just want to talk to you guys, you know, about some things that I've heard about. I said, you know, one of the things I heard is that you guys will arrest people and you'll put them in the back of vans and you'll sit them down and you'll handcuff them in chairs and you'll take a wire and wrap it around their genitals. And then it's actually hooked up to the car battery. And when you interrogate them, when they give the wrong answer, you turn the key until they give the right answer. That you actually shock their private parts in order to get compelled testimony out of them. And then you use that in court against them. I said, is that true? And they said, oh, yeah, that's true, but we don't do that. It's the police that do that. We're the prison guard. That was actually an honest answer. The prison guards don't do that. And I said, well, thanks for sharing that, but I have another question. I'm here giving a series of lectures on the death penalty. By the way, on my teaching exchange, I was asked to give four lectures on the death penalty because in 1958, Ecuador got rid of the death penalty. And they were thinking about bringing it back in 1996. It was an election year, and Abdallah Bucaram was running. He was crazy, and he would do like little heils and everything. He was like this neo-Nazi. He won, and he stayed in office for 6 months until he escaped with several million dollars to Panama. I mean, the whole thing was just crazy. But all that's going on. In the midst of that, they're having a discussion about whether they're going to bring back the death penalty. And I asked the prison guards, I said, do you think that you're going to bring back the death penalty? And they laughed at me. And I said, why are you laughing? And they said, we have the death penalty. And I said, what do you mean? No, you don't. And they said, oh, yes, we do. They said, when we have a child molester in here, or whenever we have someone who is the head of a drug cartel, we tell them that there's been a mistake in their paperwork. We open up the prison gate, and we allow them to walk out. And when they get outside the prison gate, we shoot them in the back with a machine gun. We bury their body, and we tell the warden that it was a thwarted escape attempt. How many of you have seen Shawshank Redemption? That's what they do. And they admit that it's a common practice in Ecuador. And so I sat there and I said, well, do you do that? And they said, no, it's the other guards. Now they're lying. Okay. At that point, because I saw the smiles on their faces, like those drug cartel leaders and child molesters deserve what we give them. There was a little bit too much of a gleam in their eye when they described the process. But what was really cool was I had an opportunity also to talk to two English-speaking individuals who were prisoners, one by the name of Pedro Castillo, the other one, I don't know his name. Pedro was arrested at the age of 21. They said he had a forged passport. You know the game, right? He was going to Colombia and coming back for a day trip. He lived up near Otavalo, near the border. And one of the guards said, your passport is invalid. You know what that means? It means give me some money. It's an extortion attempt. And he said, no, it's valid. And he just kept on arguing with them. They threw him in jail. And he got in jail and he saw the conditions. And he started to talk to people from the outside. His family could afford to get him upstairs. And so he sent people to communicate with the Catholic University. So his trial, they waited 3 years to commence his trial for forgery of the passport. The trial took 1 year because there's no jury, and it's just notes being passed back and forth between a judge and a prosecutor. They acquitted him, and when he was found innocent, they told him that he had to pay a processing fee to be let out. I was talking to Pedro Castillo at the age of 25. He had been in prison from 21 to 25 for something he did not do. And he was waiting on people to raise money to pay a bribe to the warden to let him out. And he told me about everything. He said, this is my calling. This is what I'm supposed to do. I'll be talking about this the rest of my life. And he says, I'm going to be an activist for prison conditions here. And it was really an amazing thing. You know, but I also talked to this other Catholic prisoner, and I sat there. I sat in his bunk, and I said, what are you doing here? He said, I was arrested for petty larceny 2 years ago. He just had a little girl that was born. He hadn't seen her in 2 years. He's waiting for his trial to commence. And if he was convicted, his penalty would be 2 months. And he's just sitting there waiting. But he was a believer. And he had a smile on his face. And he was at peace. It was incredible. And he sat there and he thanked me for coming to see him. And he said, no one cares about us. And that was the end. I'm in there for 3 hours, and I'm just overwhelmed. I go walking out of the prison. I smell like human waste. I stink. And it's drizzling out there. It's light rain in the afternoon in the Andes Mountains. And I look up and there's a picture of there's a statue of the Virgin Mary up on a hill. And I just looked at the statue. I'm standing out there. Anyone who walked by at that moment thinks this guy has lost his mind. Because I actually stopped. And this isn't for effect. This is literal. I was just so shocked. I looked up at the statue and I said, I was wrong about my atheism. Because something huge happened inside of that prison. I realized something. There is an absolute standard of right and wrong. See, because you sit there, it's kind of like you look at a picture of dead children at Auschwitz. And you cast your eyes upon something that's so unbelievably evil. What happens? It's like the Switchfoot song just goes off in your head. The shadow proves the sunshine. If you see this absolute evil, you realize, you know what? There must be a standard by which we judge this. And it completely changed my perspective. I've become a theist and eventually a Christian. But I never, ever claimed to be an atheist or agnostic after that day. Because I sat there and I began to think about it. You know what? I thought, there's a moral law out there. And it's a lot like the law of gravity. You know, you can't sit here one day and just decide, I just don't believe in gravity anymore. And expect to suddenly go floating up in the clouds. Because the law of gravity is not contingent upon our perceptions. It exists independently of us. And what I realized is it's the exact same way with the moral law. And I began to think about it. Are we the same as Ecuador? Is a country that doesn't allow you to shock confessions out of people the same as one that does? And I began to think about all of these questions. And I began to think, are we really the same as Nazi Germany? No, all cultures are not equal to one another. That is absolutely preposterous, and it's unworkable in the real world, because there are certain things that are wrong, and it doesn't matter what country it happens in or what decade it happens in, because it is timelessly, simply, morally wrong. And that's the question that you need to ask in sociology after they commit to the idea that all societies and all cultures are equal. You come back and you hit them with the question, even the Nazis. And you ask that question, and you watch the professor try and dance her way around the answer and say, oh, that's not really what I was saying. Well, that is precisely where your philosophy leads us. It leads us to the gas chamber, ladies and gentlemen. And you're not going to be able to morally persuade the professor in those circumstances, but all of your peers are listening. You asked a question she couldn't answer. You didn't make an assertion that she is accustomed to striking down. And so you're really getting somewhere. But you know, you need to understand that they don't really believe in relativism. It's selective relativism. They will talk about how all other cultures are equal. Then they'll say, except America. We're evil. We're this evil capitalist nation. And that's where I throw in this one question just for fun. This is just for fun. Oh, it's fun. Morally speaking, is a society that must build walls to keep its own citizens in the same as a society that must build walls to keep citizens of other countries out? They will talk about how we are a racist nation because we're even contemplating building a wall along the Texas border. Keep your eyes focused on the wall, because it won't be the first wall that was ever made in the course of human history. But there is a moral distinction between having a country that is so great you must build walls to keep people out, and one that is so disastrous that you must build walls to keep your own citizens in. And those two societies are not equal, ladies and gentlemen. You begin to ask these questions, and you are really going to have great, great success. But you know, there's some things. Doesn't matter what year it is. Doesn't matter what university is. I mean, just forever they've been talking about that issue. But there are some new ones that we're confronting. Every few years, there's going to be a new cause that they're going to hit you with. And without a doubt, it's going to be totally impossible for you to get very far in Sociology 101 without having a discussion of same-sex marriage. And what I find is that a lot of young students say, well, you know, I'm not real comfortable with this. I don't think this sounds right, but I don't really know how to articulate my view. It's very important that you know how to articulate your view without simply just going out and stating what that view is, because the response will just be bigot, basically. Some form of you're a bigot, some sort of ad hominem attack. And so you need to be prepared. And you notice that I only have three questions here. And one of them is concerning the issue of separation of church and state. I actually want you guys to understand that you know, because you're going to be talking about institutions, social institutions, and because marriage is a social institution, this is an inevitable debate in the sociology class. And the first day, what you have to do is get the professor on record and figure out whether they believe that traditional marriage, having only traditional marriage recognized in this country, would be a violation of separation of church and state. How many of you have heard that argument? It's like, okay, your religion believes that that's what marriage is, and if we only allow that, then we've endorsed your religion, and it's a violation of separation of church and state. How many of you have heard that? Very bad argument. Well, here's where I think it's extremely important to be a student of the history of the Supreme Court. Okay, and I know my lawyer friends who are present here will agree, we desperately need to get people to read Supreme Court decisions and understand them. You know, I walked into my class, my criminal procedure class this semester, and we were talking about the DOMA decision just real briefly. Someone brought it up, and I said, yeah, I said, unfortunately, in dictum, the way that I'm reading this case and some of Justice Kennedy's remarks, I believe they're going to move toward the constitutional right to same-sex marriage, and I think that'll lead to polygamy. And everyone just freaked out. Oh, no, that's not what we're arguing. Oh, no, 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 no. And you just see this. It's like I shot their dog. I mean, you just see these waves of emotion just rolling through the class. And I just said, oh, guys, you know, how can it lead to one but not the other under Reynolds? And they said, what is Reynolds? What's the Reynolds decision? And I said, oh, I see. You think that they haven't considered the issue of whether retaining one single definition of marriage violates the Constitution. Oh, you think the Supreme Court's never considered this issue before. That's the problem. They have. There was a case, the Reynolds case from 1879. And I bring it up and I tell people who are proponents of same-sex marriage, go read the opinion first and tell me what you think about it. It's very important for you guys to read this opinion. It's a very, very interesting opinion because there was this Mormon polygamist by the name of Reynolds who was, you know, everything was going on at that time with the issue of the recognition of Utah as a state. And a federal law had been passed, of course. It was a federal law that was banning polygamy, basically. He challenged that before the United States Supreme Court in the year 1879. And it was kind of interesting because he did make a religious freedom argument, basically, you know, free exercise of religion. And the court dismisses that and says you're free to believe what you want to believe, but you're not free to act the way that you want to act. You can't just do anything in accordance with that. And, of course, at this time, we have to understand that this is 11 years after the 14th Amendment has been ratified, which guarantees equal protection of the laws. And this is the thing we talked about last night. Many people think, oh, that means you can't discriminate. Well, no, it means you can't discriminate arbitrarily. We talked about, I either use the Ray Charles example or the Stevie Wonder example. There's a huge difference. If Stevie Wonder wants to be a bus driver, there's a big difference between saying you can't drive a bus because you're blind and you can't drive a bus because you're black. Okay, it's like one of those is rational and the other one is bigoted. Well, it's interesting. The Supreme Court pointed out that you know, long before the Mormon religion was established, in fact, long before the United States of America was established, what did we have? We just had this one definition of marriage. I mean, it's just out. That's what we've got. We're not singling you out at all. We've structured our society around this. And in no way are we arbitrarily discriminating against you. Well, I think we've got a huge problem if we come along and we say we're going to recognize same-sex marriage. Well, what then happens to the argument in Reynolds? Well, that's just the way it's always been. We've always had this one exact definition of marriage. We can't just make an exception for you. Oh, really? So you're going to have same-sex marriage but not polygamy? Which one has a greater historical basis? I mean, we've got religions that have said they accept this. Okay, I mean, we you know, let's not just focus on Mormonism right now. But my goodness, I mean, take a look at Islam, okay? What, you know, what is the reward, okay? And think about in heaven, you know? And think about what is the historical basis for polygamy. There is a vastly longer historical acceptance. Not majority acceptance, but acceptance out there. And we hadn't even heard anything about same-sex marriage until the last generation. How do they get bumped ahead in the line? And we're going to recognize you, but not you, okay? That's a serious problem. And what they want to do is to avoid the whole discussion of polygamy. And you'll notice this whenever you say, well, what about polygamy? What about incestuous unions? How do they respond to that situation? They respond by saying, oh, that's the slippery slope argument. And I always respond by saying, thank you for naming my argument. Now, could you respond to my argument? And I think we really need to press this issue by asking them, do you support polygamy? Just ask them directly. And they will try to evade the question because it is a trap. Okay, if they say, yes, I support polygamy, and you're sitting there in the sociology department, in the sociology class, oh, really? So you think that I should be able, you support same-sex marriage and polygamy and incestuous, you think I should be able to marry my brother and my sister both? I mean, there are just no limitations whatsoever. If they actually go there, then what happens? Many people in the class are turned off. And they say, well, that's just crazy. You can't just marry everyone, okay? You can't just, does everyone get benefits? And you really have undermined their argument. And they realize at that point they look extreme. That's why they try to say we can go this one step and we don't have to do the other steps. Because they don't want to look extreme. So what are they going to do in the classroom when you say, do you support polygamy? Think about it. It's a feminist. You think a man should be able to take 50 wives? She's going to say, of course not. And then she's trapped under those circumstances. You ask, why don't you support marriage equality? There are people down there, okay, my goodness. I mean, you know, we've got cases there in southern Utah and in northern Arizona where folks are living like this, and that's in accordance with their religion. Why is your view superior to theirs? Why are you trying to impose your culture upon them? Okay, why do you not support marriage equality? This works, folks. A friend of mine, Kevin Vollema, who was a staff member out at Summit Ministries for a couple of years, went off to Biola. And he ran into this liberal Christian girl who was just totally into the same-sex marriage argument. And he said, I'm on my Facebook page right now and I'm getting destroyed. Help me out. And so I said, fine, I've got tenure. I've got plenty of time. I've got nothing to do. Giddy up. I can't believe I just said that. And I went over to his page and I asked the young woman, I said, do you support polygamy? And she says, we're not discussing that right now. We're discussing same-sex marriage. I said, do you support polygamy? And she kept copying and pasting the same response over and over and over. And I said, will you fight for the rights of polygamists to marry whomever they want if they are in fact consenting adults? And she just left the conversation. And I said, come back later when you really believe in marriage equality and you're willing to say that you're morally superior to us because you actually believe in what you're saying. Boom. Credibility gone. She just disappeared from the conversation and never came back. Here's the deal. We allow them to dismiss the polygamy argument as being a slippery slope argument. And that's something that we can't do. We've really got to press that issue because there is no right answer for them in the classroom. So we need to pursue that. Now, let me tell you something else that's going to be popping up with great regularity in that class. What's going to be popping up is a discussion of what causes crime and deviance. And this is where the discussion that we're having today becomes really relevant to the basics of the Christian worldview. I mean, do you guys ever look around our society and you notice it's like you got these liberals in a room over here and they agree with each other on everything, and then you've got these conservatives in this room over there and they agree with each other over everything, but then you let them out of their rooms and they start arguing, and it's like they disagree with one another about everything, and it's like, how is there this consistent similarity within the groups and difference between the groups? And you kind of wonder if there's some simple explanation for that. The fact of the matter is that there is a simple explanation for that. The whole argument that we're having between liberals and conservatives in the United States of America really boils down to an argument about human nature. And we really need to understand that, because we just had this conversation about capitalism versus socialism a little bit earlier in this talk. And you think about it, you've got these individuals who think that socialism will work and these other folks who think that it won't. Well, how does socialism work? It works if I'm such a good person that I don't mind giving up my stuff and working for other people, even though it will have no impact upon my well-being. Don't I have to be a fundamentally good, well-meaning person? But what if I have a deep-down desire to compete with other individuals? Okay, what if that's within me? Don't I need capitalism? It's like, oh, that guy, his business is doing better than mine. Well, I need to compete with him. And then, oh, I pass him the next month. And then he comes back and he competes with me. If that's in my nature, then capitalism is going to cause us to lift one another up. And the people who stay behind will stay behind because they want to stay behind. Okay, but most people will actually join in the competition. And so the question is, what is our nature? Well, Genesis 3 answers the question. We only get three chapters in the Bible before we figure out exactly what human nature is like. It's our first experiment with socialism. We have utopia, the Garden of Eden. We have two individuals and one rule. And the humans mess the whole thing up. You think Obamacare can work? Oh my goodness, ladies and gentlemen. We've got one rule and two people. And then what happens? We've got the fall. Okay? And we understand when we read the Bible that the Judeo-Christian tradition is rooted in a dim, tragic view of human nature, of man and woman as fallen beings. And this has implications that run so far outside of the realm of economics. I mean, it applies to foreign policy as well, doesn't it? I mean, what happens if, let's just say that you had this crazy dictator somewhere and he just suddenly decides that he's going to start invading other countries. Call him Hitler or instead just call him Putin, perhaps. You know, what do you do when something like that happens? Well, you know, Ronald Reagan was a conservative, and he said we can win the Cold War by doing what? By building an arsenal, breaking their economy, but also building an arsenal that says, you know what, you need to be very careful if you encroach on our territory, because we're going to hold you in check. But you know what, if you don't have that view, if you don't think that war and conquest is a function of human nature, but people are fundamentally good, well, then how do conflicts arise in the realm of foreign policy? Well, then they must be a function of misunderstandings. And if they're a function of misunderstandings, all you need to have is one giant building with a bunch of headsets. And, oh, all the people are speaking different languages. If they could all speak the same language, then we could all just come together, as John Lennon said. Imagine. Of course, the conservatives look at that and say, oh, no, that is a waste of prime real estate in Midtown Manhattan. Okay? But it is a fundamental difference in worldview. It's like if human nature is negative, you need to hold it in check. And so quite obviously, this is going to come up in the context of discussions of the criminal justice system. I mean, you think about what is the function of the criminal justice system? Well, if you have this view of the world that people are good, then the purpose is to rehabilitate people because the society has written bad things on their slate and we need to go erase those bad things and write good things. That's known as rehabilitation. But if you don't subscribe to that way of thinking and you're a conservative, well, what do you think? You think if human nature is bad, we've got to hold it in check. That's why the emphasis on family values. That's why the emphasis on objective morality. You know, you have to teach people to hold things in check by making them feel guilty when they do something that's wrong. But you have to understand that the individuals who teach those values are also fallen beings. And they're going to make mistakes when they raise people because they're not perfect. So we need a backup plan. And the backup plan is called the criminal justice system. If guilt doesn't do it, then fear will. We need to have punishment that is swift and certain and fairly severe. And obviously, you know, what we see is that this difference in worldview translates into how we manage public policy and major social institutions. So this becomes an important part of what they're doing. You notice the heading of this third part says, questions intended to challenge the notion that people are good. A big task for them, therefore, will be to teach the kid that human beings are good. So what will they do? They will parade out a number of different theories. An example of this, and we'll take a break in just what, about 10 minutes probably, okay? But I want to work through this because it is so incredibly important. They will teach these various theories, labeling theory, okay? It's interesting, labeling theory was developed in criminology. It says basically, Frank Tannenbaum is this sociologist that developed it, and he said, you know, everyone does bad things, but only some people get caught. And if they get caught, then they're put under greater supervision. And if they're then put under greater supervision, then that means they're more likely to be caught again. And if you keep catching them, a guy by the name of Edwin Lemert, another sociologist, came along and said eventually it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that if you label someone as delinquent, they begin to believe that it's true. And then that's how they are transformed into being a delinquent. And it's sort of interesting, isn't it? If you buy into the Judeo-Christian tradition, what do you say? If you make the bad choice to commit a crime, you'll be labeled as a delinquent. They say, oh no, it's the opposite. The labeling causes the crime. See, it's not like we disagree a little bit. The sociological worldview and the Judeo-Christian worldview are at opposite ends of the spectrum. They're not done yet. They'll say, oh, we have this other theory known as social strain theory. When people have blocked opportunities and they're unable to get jobs and they're unable to get an education, it causes them to undergo strain and that transforms into criminal conduct. They go out. What they can't get through legitimate means, they get through illegitimate means, and that's what causes criminality. Okay, well, no, that's not the Judeo-Christian perspective. It's just the opposite. If you make the bad choice to commit a crime, it's going to be difficult for you to get a job and difficult for you to get into college, okay? It will impede your opportunities. They say, no, it's the opposite. The blocked opportunities came first, then the crime was second. And it just goes on and on. Differential association theory. If you're surrounded by peers who are delinquent and they teach you definitions and perceptions of crime, peer pressure, as being favorable, smoke this, drink this, inject that, steal that. You see, differential association theory is like this learning theory that says that delinquent perceptions of delinquency as being favorable from the peer group cause the crime. But then you think about what the Judeo-Christian perspective says. It says, hold on just a second. Where did all the delinquency in the group come from? I mean, you haven't described the genesis of the criminal activity. You know, maybe if you commit a crime, conformists won't want to hang out with you. You'll be ostracized and forced to hang out with other people in delinquent peer associations. Birds of a feather flock together. So they're at exact opposite ends of the spectrum. And so you walk into the sociology class, and what do they say? Studies have proved that labeling exerts a significant influence on crime. Studies have proved that social strain exerts a significant influence on crime. Studies have proved that differential association, peer association with delinquent peers, exerts a positive or exerts a direct correlation on crime. And they sit there and they say that all these things are proved. But then you've got to ask the question directly. Look at this strain of questions here. Strain was a poor choice of words. Does labeling cause crime or does crime cause labeling? Just pick a theory and they'll say, oh no, labeling causes crime. You get them to commit. And then you ask them, are most of these studies cross-sectional? And then boom, they're in huge trouble because you cannot conduct experiments of crime for ethical reasons. You see, we can't do controlled experiments among young people. We can't have two rooms and have a control group of six youths sitting around in this room. And then in the experimental condition, let's put a gun in the room and a keg of beer and see what happens. You're not allowed to do these experiments, so they do surveys. And it's fantastically oversimplified because they'll walk into the high school, and many of you in high school have taken the survey, and they'll ask the question, what is your gender? What is your race? How much money do your parents make? And so on and so forth. And they'll go through the demographics. And then they'll start to ask the theoretical questions. How often has one of your teachers labeled you as being criminal or deviant? How many of your peers have been on probation? How many of your peers smoke marijuana? How many times have you perceived that you couldn't get a job or couldn't get into college for X or Y reason? And they ask all these questions that are supposed to be the cause, the liberal cause of crime. And then they move on and they ask the question, a series of questions. In the last year, have you used or done the following? And they ask about sex and violence and alcohol use and drug use. Isn't that interesting? The cause is supposed to come before the effect. You just ask questions about their present social circumstances, and then you ask them how much crime they committed in the last year. So they find a correlation between the two. They measured it backwards. And the correlation exist between labeling and delinquency. And they say, look, that proves our theory. No, you said that labeling came first and then delinquency came second. You just measured present labeling and past delinquency. This is how corrupt sociology is. They will conduct these cross-sectional studies, even if the questions were worded correctly. There's no way that you could establish cause and effect. But the correlation actually proves that the Judeo-Christian perspective is correct. And then they report the results as, it's a correlation, therefore we win. It's unbelievable academic dishonesty. Does everyone understand that sociology isn't a science? It's not a science. It's social philosophy. And they do these studies that are intentionally deceptive, and they just tell you, they have found. The most prolific researcher in the history of the planet is Dr. They. They found. But they don't tell you what's the name of the study and could I please see the survey instrument and look at the final questions. How do you separate cause and effect in the cross-sectional study? And then continue to ask questions. What percentage of delinquency is explained by labeling? And they'll have to report, for example, that their studies, even wrongly constructed, only explain about 10% of the variation in delinquent behavior. And you just want to ask, what's the other 90%? The other 90%, if only 10% is explained by these correlations, which are backwards anyway, what's the other 90%? You know the answer. I know the answer. It's the individual free will. Because the Judeo-Christian perspective is correct. It hasn't been disproven by junk science. You need to learn to ask questions, and you need to get this down, even if it means reading Greg Kokel's tactics and refreshing your familiarity with what? With the Colombo tactic. You see, that will teach you the mindset of taking sociology, of asking the questions they don't want you to ask, because they're on the wrong side of this fight. We'll come back in a few minutes and talk about the abortion issue. Thank you so much.